From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
NASA has again been certified by an independent board as a bumbling bureaucracy with minimum concern for safety. And that comes just as NASA embarks on a greatly expanded program using nuclear power in space.
A report on the Columbia crash says NASA will suffer more accidents if it doesn't change its culture. We'll talk about another deportation, this including 9 Palestinians from the United States. And we'll go to protesters in Taos, New Mexico, outside the house of Donald Rumsfeld, who's meeting with Dick Cheney.
Hey, lots to go.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A report on the loss of Space Shuttle Columbia predicts NASA will suffer similar tragedies, killing more astronauts if it does not transform its, quote, broken safety culture. The report focused on both the physical errors that caused Columbia to explode on its February 1st mission, as well as the work culture at NASA. The explosion killed 7, marks the second time in 20 years a space shuttle blew up. Investigators determine NASA's engineering has grown careless, its safety system flawed, and communication with the agency muddled. NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe has also been cited for creating the problematic culture. The board did recommend the government should spend more money on NASA, but one analyst told the New York Times, the problem is the program is worthless. It doesn't involve anything worth dying for. The Congressional Budget Office yesterday predicted the federal budget will keep growing even if the economy improves. The New York Times reports this in sharp contrast to projections by the White House that claims the deficit will hit nearly $500 billion next year and then decline significantly. U.S. official Paul Bremer, who is heading the occupation of Iraq, told the Washington Post, quote, almost impossible to exaggerate the amount of money needed to reconstruct Iraq. He says, quote, several tens of billions of dollars will be needed. 2 U.S. soldiers were killed today in separate attacks in Baghdad and a city just to the west. The deaths brought to 281 the number of soldiers killed since the invasion began on March 20th. Since President Bush declared major combat over on May 1st, 143 American soldiers have died, more than died during the invasion. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting U.S. and Israel are looking into the possibility of reconstructing an old oil pipeline to transport oil from Iraq to Israeli refineries in Haifa. The pipeline was last used in 1948. Haaretz reports Israeli Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon sees the reopening of the pipeline as a possible, quote, bonus for Israel's support of the U.S. during the Iraqi invasion. International inspectors said yesterday they discovered particles of highly enriched uranium weapons in or highly enriched weapons grade uranium in Iran that might indicate Tehran may soon be able to develop nuclear weapons. The finding was included in a confidential report by the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna that was leaked to the press. Israeli forces killed 1 Palestinian and wounded more than 20 others in a failed attempt to assassinate 3 members of Hamas in Gaza. The BBC reports it was the 3rd strike on Hamas in the last 5 days. Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root has been awarded a no-bid contract to expand the U.S. military base at Guantanamo Bay. The extra space will allow the U.S. to hold 10% more detainees at the base. The Missouri Supreme Court yesterday overturned the death sentence of a man who was 17 when he killed a woman a decade ago. The court found that, quote, a national consensus has developed against the execution of juvenile offenders. The Associated Press is reporting a group of conservatives in Nevada plan to notify the Secretary of State's office today that it intends to recall Republican Governor Kenny Gwynn. The pro-recall groups are protesting the governor's decision to impose record tax increases. If opponents can gather some 125,000 signatures, a recall vote could take place similar to the one in California. Gwynn was elected to office last year. Speaking of California, chief unions in California have voted to support the Lieutenant Governor Bustamante for governor, but to vote no on recall. A church minister in Milwaukee was charged yesterday with physical abuse of a child and could face up to 10 years in prison after an 8-year-old autistic boy died while church leaders were trying to heal him at a storefront church. Police say the boy suffocated after a church elder sat on his chest while trying to remove the, quote, evil spirits from him. General Wesley Clark yesterday accused the White House of pressuring CNN to fire him as a military analyst during the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. Clark told a radio station in Phoenix the White House apparently called CNN to request his ouster. In Rwanda, Paul Kagame has won the country's first presidential multi-party election since the 1994 genocide. He received 94% of the vote. And bioweapons scientist Dr. Stephen Hatfill is suing the Justice Department and the FBI. He accuses the government of smearing his name during the investigation of the anthrax attacks in 2001. Hatfill has been identified as a, quote, person of interest in the case. The government has been closely monitoring him for months. Hatfill's lawyers said the government, quote, embarked on a highly public campaign to accuse Hatfill without formally naming him a suspect or charging him with any wrongdoing. Space is the place. Sun Ra here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The report on the space shuttle Columbia predicts that NASA will suffer similar tragedies, killing more astronauts if it doesn't transform its culture. The report focused on both the physical errors that caused Columbia to explode on its February 1st mission, as well as the work culture at NASA. The explosion killed seven, marking the second time in 20 years a space shuttle has blown up. Investigators determined NASA's engineering had grown careless, its safety system flawed, and communication within the agency muddled. NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe was also cited for creating the problematic culture. The review board determined the space shuttle's problems stem from a problem during the liftoff when a 1.7-pound piece of foam insulation fell off, hitting the shuttle's wing at 500 miles per hour, causing some damage. The investigators found the culture at NASA, where policies and managers were seldom critiqued, led to the agency being unable to make possible fixes after the problem occurred. Among other things, it was reported the agency never obtained pictures of the space shuttle of Columbia in orbit that may have displayed the extent of the damage. As the Washington Post put it today, they had requested the photographs from the Pentagon. They said low-level engineers and officials requested at least three times the Defense Department use its network of high-powered telescopes and satellites to take pictures of the shuttle's damaged left wing. But the requests were either neither acted on or blocked because of inadequate, imprecise, or conflicting follow-ups by the space agency. The board did recommend the government should spend more money on NASA, but one analyst told the New York Times, the problem is the program is worthless. It doesn't involve anything worth dying for. We're joined on the telephone right now by Carl Grossman. He's the author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet. He's also a professor of journalism at the State University of New York at Old Westbury. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carl Grossman. Tell us your analysis of this report. You have been reporting on NASA for decades.
Well, I'm heartened that we have another commission declaring that NASA is essentially a bumbling bureaucracy out of control with very minimal concern for safety. I mean, one of the lines in the report is so telling. NASA's organizational culture has much to do with this accident as foam did.
Talk about that culture.
It's a culture in which criticism is not welcomed. I mean, I know this from whistleblowers, insiders in NASA who have come to me through the years. Whether it's a low-level person or a mid-level person concerned about the foam striking the shuttle in this particular situation, or thousands, millions of concerns that NASA employees have, you don't open your mouth, you don't raise a concern. This is not an agency with, as this commission report said, with checks and balances. Again, its report does not have an independent safety program, has not demonstrated the characteristics of a learning organization. And that's really important. I mean, they always talk about lessons learned. Apparently, at NASA, lessons are not learned.
Can you talk about what you have most focused on, and that is nuclear material in space, and what that has to do with this report?
Well, my biggest concern goes back into the 1980s. I broke the story in 1986 about the Challenger's next mission to be a mission involving it lofting plutonium into space. That would have been in May of 86 if it hadn't blown up in January of 86. Now NASA is involved in a great expansion, a sweeping expansion of its space nuclear program. This Sean O'Keefe calls it Project Prometheus. NASA's good at these catchy names and titles. $3 billion is to be spent over the next 5 years on all kinds of space nuclear projects, including a nuclear-propelled rocket. I mean, this is a scheme which NASA spent billions on way back in the 50s and 60s into the early 70s. The major reason that this was canceled was out of concern for a nuclear rocket crashing back to Earth. But Sean O'Keefe is gung-ho nuclear. In fact, there's a personal angle here. In an interview with a nuclear energy trade publication, Sean O'Keefe talks about at the dinner table at night being regaled by stories from his father, who was in the nuclear navy, about the wonders of atomic propulsion at sea. And then he goes on, Sean O'Keefe, saying that we're going to bring nuclear power to a new dimension above all our heads. The L.A. Times quoted Sean O'Keefe as saying, we're talking about doing something, again, this Project Prometheus, on a very aggressive schedule, talking about getting missions up, nuclear-propelled rocket missions up by the end of the decade. So here you have this agency that can't shoot right in space being charged with negligence, I mean serious negligence, in connection with the death of the seven astronauts on Columbia. And it goes back, this history of ineptness, incompetence, and lack of concern for safety, moving to do all kinds of things nuclear in space. And we're not volunteers. I mean, the astronauts were volunteers. We're not. And to embark on this foolish atomic course endangering lots of life, not to be anthropomorphic, lots of life on Earth, for this agency to do this is just horrific, and it just must be stopped.
And how would you suggest that it be stopped?
Well, I think critically, it's important that people know what's going on, and there's not a whisper, not a touch in the coverage this morning or last night about. And I think it's very much connected because this is Sean O'Keefe's big project, this Project Prometheus, and I think people have to know. And thank heavens for you, Amy, and for Democracy Now, we're getting the word across to a good degree this morning. But I think people should write letters to the editor. People should shake up the media, or whatever the media is these days, in their areas and get some attention on this space nuclear program. Then there's a very good organization that I would suggest people connect to, and that's the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. You go to their website. It's www.space4peace.org. I put together a number of videos on this issue of nukes in space, and you can give a call to Enviro Video at 1-800-326-8846.
That's Carl Grossman.
326-8846. Show these videos in churches and schools. And people just have to know what NASA has been up to and what it plans to do now and how that will be endangering all our lives.
Well, Carl Grossman, thanks very much for being with us, author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet. He's a professor of journalism at the State University of New York, Old Westbury. You are listening to Democracy Now! It's time to fire Rumsfeld. That was the headline of an editorial in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer that appeared in the paper on Sunday. The paper's editorial board writes, "The United States has more serious problems in Iraq than President Bush could have imagined when he declared major combat at an end. Before he faces more surprises, the nation's first MBA president should take management action. Relieve Donald Rumsfeld as defense secretary." The editorial goes on to say the president needs a defense department in which professional views about what military force levels hold sway. Change can occur without perpetual turmoil, and military planning avoids undermining diplomacy. None of that is likely under the domineering Rumsfeld. The Post-Intelligencer may have become the first major paper in the country to call for Rumsfeld's ouster. But yesterday in Taos, New Mexico, a group of protesters had a similar message. They gathered outside of one of Rumsfeld's properties. Inside, in his house, he was there with the vice president, Dick Cheney. We talked to one of the protesters outside.
Hi, my name is Marielle Nanassi, and I'm with the Action Coalition of Taos, and that stands for ACT. And we've been protesting for the last 9 months against the – we came together against the war in Iraq. And we had that on October 26th when the rest of the world was protesting. We were protesting as well. And at that time, we had the largest demonstration in northern New Mexico's history. And we have been demonstrating because Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Offense, has six properties here. And right now we are protesting because Rumsfeld is here and Dick Cheney, Vice President, came to join him. And about half an hour ago, Dick Cheney landed at the Taos Municipal Airport. And we had a big banner there. A couple of us were at the airport with a big banner that said, "Act Against War and Empire, Act Now for Peace." And then at the same time, there was a number of people in front of the Fetchin Inn, which is a local hotel here, where a number of Cheney's security is staying. Right, and then we moved to where his motorcade had proceeded to, which is one of the main houses of Rumsfeld, which is in the middle of a little town called El Prado. which is part of Taos County, and there's about 50 of us here, and we have signs that say Cheney equals corporate greed, people over profits. Second, Taos welcomes the second war criminal, butcher of the environment, no Cheney. We have one that says prosecute Cheney in the world court. No Cheney, no Rumsfeld, no evil empire. Yes to democracy and justice. There's a couple of people wearing Cheney masks. One of them who's wearing a red, white, and blue shirt and a Cheney mask, and it says, Cheney Bush lied, our soldiers died. And we've been coming here and protesting Rumsfeld for a long time, and now, you know, we have Cheney joining him. And we're, you know, it's basically that we are protesting the corporate greed that Cheney represents in our government, because it's like a revolving door between business and government, with Cheney being the sort of epitome of that. And that's why we're out here, especially, you know, today we know that he is still refusing to have open government and allow the allow us to find out who he met with the Energy Task Force. And we think that the reason is because he is, you know, racking up millions and billions of dollars with no corporate accountability. You know, we know that he met with Ken Lay of Enron, but who else did he meet with? And it seems to me that, or it seems to us, excuse me, that the, you know, the corporations are really running our country right now. And people are driving by and beeping and waving and giving us a peace sign. And so it's us and the people who are driving by and then a bunch of police.
You're not so far away from Los Alamos and New Mexico. No. Well, people say if it were to secede from the United States, it would be the third largest nuclear power in the world. Yeah. What about that proximity to the really heart of nuclear America?
Well, I don't know if you all know this, but that Rumsfeld was actually given an award, a Keeper of the Flame Award, during the Clinton administration, because he promoted so heavily the keeping of the possibility of nuclear weapons in space. I mean, I think Cheney was just here in Albuquerque trying to raise money with Heather Wilson. And, you know, this is the nuclear capital of the world, and this is what they both stand for, using the money that we have, or the government has taken from us, really, I should say, to promote all kinds of militarism, and the nuclear aspect is one element of it, but it's certainly the scariest element. And it's so scary because, you know, when they're talking about warring, if something, quote-unquote, goes wrong, then, you know, we could have devastation that is not only immediate but that is long-lasting for generations to come. And that I'm a mother, and it scares me personally, and I, you know, that's why we're out here.
Marielle Nanasi with Action Coalition of Taos. A group of people protested outside one of the homes of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld yesterday as he was meeting with Vice President Dick Cheney. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
والشعر ليال غجرية غجرية والبسمة صفا غجرية غجرية والشعر ليال غجرية غجرية والبسمة صفا من كفك طالع موال 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 في عيونك شجر الأفراح
شجر الأفراح
طالع موال
موال موالي
شجر الأفراح
شجر الأفراح
أجرية أجرية
Najariya by Waleed Taufil here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the past 2 years, non-immigrant residents in the United States from more than 20 countries have been targeted for special registration, facing the specter of indefinite detention and possible deportation. When non-citizens go before an immigration judge, the court is not required to appoint legal representation. 80% to 90% of them end up without lawyers and are unable to contest deportation orders. Detainees generally face deportation because of visa violations or criminal charges and are sent back to their countries of origin if those countries accept them. The situation of Palestinian detainees is unique in that they're stateless people, so they have no home country authorized to take them in. The U.S. Departments of Justice and Homeland Security have worked out a deal with Israel, Jordan, and Egypt to facilitate the return of Palestinian deportees to the West Bank and Gaza. The Palestinian Authority is also facing pressure to permit deportees to be sent to refugee camps. Immigrant rights groups say the U.S. should not deport Palestinians to areas racked by violence. Well, last Tuesday, the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement deported 9 Palestinians as part of another mass deportation of up to 24 people. They were deported from a detention facility they were brought to outside Buffalo, New York, on a chartered plane along with Egyptians and Jordanians. 54-year-old Palestinian Munir Lami was blind and diabetic. He was among those deported. He had served time in prison for welfare fraud and a visa violation, but was released until July because the immigration authorities apparently didn't have sufficient documentation to deport him. Upon arriving in Jordan last week, he was placed in a prison without the knowledge of his family for several days. Lami has lived in the United States for 16 years, raised 9 children here, as well as 8 grandchildren. We turn first to Sabash Katil, who is with Families for Freedom in New York City. Can you tell us more about the case of this man, of Munir Lami?
I mean, Munir Lami is another person who's part of just a greater attempt of what we've been seeing over the past couple months, in which a while back in June 2001, the Supreme Court had ruled that indefinite detention was unconstitutional. And by saying that, it said that stateless people and people that were unable to be deported within a reasonable amount of time were to be released from immigration custody, So in that process, folks from Guyana, folks from Cambodia, folks from places like Somalia, folks from places like Palestine were released from INS custody because they were unable to be deported. What we've seen over the past year is the INS has openly flouted the Supreme Court decision, and in the face of the Supreme Court decision, it has really put pressure on consulates around the country, I mean consulates around the world, and on countries around the world to take back stateless folks, take back people that they refused to take back in the past. And the Lami case is another situation where there was a person released because he couldn't be deported because the Supreme Court has said that trying to keep him in custody is unconstitutional. And then they go ahead and put pressure on the Jordanian government, on the Egyptian government, on the Israeli government to find other ways to take him back into the country.
Can you explain what happened to Munir Lami when he was deported to Jordan? Why did he end up in prison there?
I mean, why he ended up in prison is actually anybody's guess. What we do know is that in some countries, in countries like Egypt, in countries like Israel, and in countries like Jordan, and also in some of the Caribbean countries, when folks are deported, either when they're deported because they're not citizens of that stated country, or because they're being deported for a prior criminal conviction that's sometimes held by government authorities or because of the political activities they're involved in before. in their countries of origin. Why Mr. Lami was detained by Jordanian officials, I'm not exactly sure. What I do know is, I mean, the United States is a signatory to the Convention Against Torture. And one of the things that the Convention Against Torture states that you can't send individuals back to situations where they will face imprisonment and torture. And so in a lot of ways, the United States is violating its own laws by deporting Palestinians back to Palestine, number one, but also deporting Palestinians and deporting other stateless people back to countries where they most certainly face persecution and most certainly face the probability of being imprisoned and being tortured.
We're also joined on the telephone by David Venturella, who's Deputy Director for Detention and Removal Operations at the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, as well as Ann Benson, who is the Directing Attorney with Washington Defenders Association Immigration Project. Can you respond to this case, David Venturella?
Well,
could you come off your cell phone? Could you come off your speakerphone, please?
Sure, no problem. First of all, the gentleman was correct in citing the Supreme Court decision regarding the indefinite detention. However, we do have an obligation to continue with pursuing an individual's removal, whether they're in custody or not. And as he characterized, Zavidas' decision by the Supreme Court did put pressure on the federal government to continue to pursue removals of individuals who had gone through the process and had their day in court and had an order of removal issued by an immigration authority. So we continue to pursue removals, even though we may not be authorized to detain them for longer periods of time based on the Supreme Court's ruling. So he's correct there, but if I could clarify that the U.S. government will still pursue the removal of individuals who have outstanding orders. The ruling does not afford them status in the United States. In fact, that removal order is outstanding until it's enforced. So it's we as immigration officers have to enforce the law, and we do abide by all decisions by Supreme Courts and other authorities. But our mission is to remove individuals who have an outstanding removal order.
Hmm. Ann Benson, can you respond to this?
Well, I think that the point that I would like to respond to is that people getting their day in court, and I think that one of the things that's most important to highlight here is that, yes, that's what the government is doing. They are actually trying to affect what they believe to be valid orders of deportation when they continue the process of trying to remove folks. But I think that it's important to highlight perhaps a step further back in terms of the quality of the day in court that people get. I think that, as you have highlighted, Amy, 80% to 90% of the people who actually appear in removal proceedings, as they are now called, are unrepresented, particularly if they are detained and if they are facing deportation for any type of criminal violation. Under the process of law that we have here, deportation and removal is still considered to be a civil proceeding, and so folks are not entitled to have lawyers appointed for them if they cannot afford counsel. And without effective lawyering, it's very hard to have your day in court in a way that's very meaningful, in a way that actually could mean that you could challenge the laws that are being applied to you. I wasn't specifically involved in Mr. Lami's case, but I note from some of the facts that have been provided to me, I seriously question the due process of law that was afforded to him, and that if he, him and so many other folks, I mean, that without adequate legal representation, it's really impossible to end up with anything other than an order of deportation.
Could you respond to that, David Venturella, of the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement?
Well, I'm not going to debate whether or not...
Off your speakerphone, please.
I don't think it's the speakerphone. I just think it's my phone. But as far as the process and whether or not he had his day in court, as the young lady stated correctly, these are civil proceedings, and there's no obligation to provide a government-appointed attorney. That's the difference between the civil proceedings and criminal proceedings. However, the immigration court, which is not overseen by the Department of Homeland Security but by the Department of Justice, The judges there do inform the individual of their rights. They do give them opportunities to seek counsel. They grant a number of continuances to allow for this opportunity. And it's up to the individual to procure the services of adequate counsel.
What does it mean to say they give them the right to seek counsel?
Give them the opportunity to seek counsel.
Could you come off your speakerphone? It would make it much easier for us to understand you. It was much better before.
I don't think I had that ability right now. Unfortunately, this phone doesn't allow me to get off the speaker.
Okay.
So I'll speak louder and hopefully it'll come across.
Okay.
But individuals are informed of the charges against them in the notice to appear, which is a charging document that Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau issues to individuals, saying what violations of the immigration statutes they're being charged with. And an immigration judge reads those charges, asks if the individual understands them, asks them if they have counsel. And if not, and the alien wishes to seek counsel, in most cases, the immigration judge will grant a continuance to allow for the individual to procure the services of legal counsel.
And, Benson, do you find that to be the case with the thousands of people who have been detained now?
Well, I just actually spent all of last Thursday in the immigration court proceedings that were held in the detention center here in Seattle. And what's interesting is that, yes, the immigration judge does read the charges and give people the opportunity to seek counsel and a continuance. Oftentimes it's a 1 week continuance to get counsel. The thing is that they could give people continuances for, into the next millennium to get counsel. But if you are in the detention center and you have very significant language limitations and you have very little money or no money, it doesn't really matter. And the charges are read to people in English. My experience after doing this for 13 years is watching people in detention who are, extremely distressed because of the situation that they are in and the separation that they're already enduring from their families is they're very much like deer in the headlights, in many respects. And it's important to remember that immigration law is perhaps one of the most complicated areas of law in our system. And my experience is that, even immigration counsel, particularly when you're dealing with people who are facing issues of detention and removal for criminal convictions, it's such a complicated area of law that without counsel, it's impossible to really think that you're going to get any kind of day in court, and people simply aren't able to get counsel. There aren't adequate public interest organizations that can meet the need, and as we have already adequately talked about here, there is no process whereby people are appointed attorneys. So what happens oftentimes after the second continuance when people haven't been able to get lawyers, the judges will simply go forward with the process. And the Attorney General, who has the authority over the immigration courts at this point, has recently imposed case completion goals on the immigration courts. And so the immigration judges are very focused now on moving the cases forward through their docket in a very rapid manner because the case completion goals require, I think it's a 30-day completion for cases in detention. And so what has begun to happen in an increased way than from where it was before is that the immigration judges, because of these pressures, are extremely focused on moving people through the system as rapidly as possible.
David Venturella of the Bureau of Immigration Customs Enforcement, what about the issue of the Supreme Court ruling that indefinite detention is unconstitutional? There are people in detention facilities now like Farouk Abdelmouti, who is a Palestinian man who's been moved from New Jersey to Pennsylvania detention facilities, who's been in prison for well over a year.
Before I address that, I want to address a couple things that were raised. In the last couple of years, we've stepped up our efforts to allow pro bono organizations and other legal advocacy groups into our facilities to conduct Know Your Rights presentations to detainees who may not have legal counsel available to them
at the point that they're arrested. We also provide all of our detainees with list of legal services. We've increased the access to phone and to legal presentations. And I think that the one thing that the lady from Washington points out is that there are not enough pro bono organizations who can provide those types of services. But we do everything we can to provide at least the access to these individuals and provide them with information about the process. And it comes from outside attorneys, not government attorneys, not government-appointed officials advising them of their rights in the process. It's immigrant advocacy groups or pro bono organizations that provide that information to them. So that's one point I wanted to clarify. On the case that you mentioned, I'm not familiar with all aspects of that particular case, but individuals, the whole process can take days or years. The Supreme Court decision talked about at the point an individual received a removal order that the time allotted was about 6 months. However, if there are circumstances which permitted the detention beyond that, that was permissible, but they had to be very specific reasons to hold someone beyond the customary or normal 6 months. So in the case that you refer to, again, I'm not sure at what stage he is in his removal proceedings, but if he's on an appeal, it could take several months and or years before he gets a removal order.
And Benson, what about this issue of indefinite detention?
Well, actually, interestingly, the indefinite detention cases originated here in Seattle with the federal public defender offices that we have here, and the federal public defenders here were the folks who argued that before the Supreme Court, so I'm somewhat familiar with that litigation. And interestingly, while the Supreme Court in the Zedvitas case said that persons cannot be held for longer than 6 months if they can't be deported, what we've experienced here in Seattle, and I know it's happened around the country, is that the government has continued to resist efforts to actually release them in compliance with the law. And in virtually every case that we have here in Seattle, the federal public defenders are having to go back into federal court and do habeas corpus petitions for each one of these folks in order to actually get the government to comply with the efforts to release people pursuant to the Zedvitas Supreme Court decision.
We've released thousands of people since that decision came out. And yes, there are habeas challenges in court that come before the six-month removal period. But to say that across the country we've continued to detain people in defiance of the Supreme Court order is just unfounded. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I can almost assuredly it's in the thousands that we've released because of the Zavidas decision.
I mean, in many of those cases where people have been released, though, they've actually had to petition for their own release, they've actually had to be insisted upon their own release.
Subhash Katil of Families for Freedom.
If you look at the Zavidas decision and the regulation that came out afterwards, that they do have to make a request to be released based on the Zavidas decision, that they view that their removal is not immediate or in the foreseeable future. That is correct, and they do that in the form of a habeas petition. But they'll do it the day after they get a removal order, not 6 months after.
And then, But again,
the point is we release thousands of people in compliance with the Zavidas decision.
I mean, the way folks like Munir Lami and other folks that were picked up in this recent round of Palestinian folks that are already out of INS custody is really telling. I mean, a lot of people that we've talked to, both in the Palestinian community and other communities that have been rounded up in the past week and deported, were told to report to the INS for either their monthly visitation reports, not told that they're going to be detained when they do report, and in some cases were actually approached by INS agents at their homes. And I mean, they're not given time to even tie ends up over here before they leave. They're not given time to sit and eat with their family before they leave. Often their lawyers aren't told when they're being detained, when they check in for the monthly appointments. I mean, to say that this is a transparent process is actually not true, especially for the family members that go through this. I mean, in the past week alone, we've heard of people that have been asked to check in with the INS and have received letters where they're supposed to check in, I'm sorry, with the Department of Homeland Security and with the Bureau of Immigrant and Customs Enforcement. They were told to check in, not told they're going to be detained, come with the travel documents, and then within a one-week period are then processed for deportation back to their home country. And, I mean, this is not an open and transparent process at all.
They all have
excuse me, sir. And it's one of...
Hold on. They all have outstanding orders of removal. When they're released, they're told to report in that they need to pursue a travel document for their removal, and then ultimately, if we're successful, they will be removed from the United States. People are called in instead of showing up at their homes or pulling them out of their jobs or elsewhere.
So people are called for what they believe are monthly check-ins. So they've checked in once a month for the past 12 months, and then all of a sudden on one random check-in, they're detained into custody. And in many cases, they're not even given a chance to contact their family, and in many cases, their attorneys don't even know. For example, for a lot of the Palestinian detainees that were transferred to Batavia, their attorneys weren't even notified that they were being transferred to Batavia, which is in Buffalo, which is where a lot of the Palestinians were deported from.
And I would confirm that the same has been true here, and as many of you may be familiar with the Somali deportation litigation.
This is Ann Benson from Seattle.
That was the case that the Bureau of, well, at the time it was still the Immigration and Naturalization Service, either issued people these letters that were very ambiguous, and, you know, people didn't know that they weren't their monthly reporting letters, these very ambiguous letters that actually were essentially luring them back into the INS so that they would just show up, or they actually went out to their homes and rounded them up with essentially no notice of what was happening here. That was essentially what gave rise to the Somali deportation litigation, but it all happened extremely rapidly. Like within a period of 48 hours, we had to be in court filing habeas corpus petitions because these people were literally just plucked off the street. And yes, they were people who were under orders of supervision.
Yeah. And the other thing that I want to point out is that when we notify individuals to come into the office, they have a tendency not to show up. And I point to the fact that we have over 400,000 unexecuted removal orders in the United States. And that's a result of us trying to give the individual an opportunity to come in on their own and effect the removal order. And as a result, it's been highly unsuccessful. So we,
David Ventura, let me just ask a quick question.
Supervision,
how many people...
Of their responsibilities and obligations, and that it one day it may result in a removal. That order does not go away because you're released from ICE custody. That order is still in effect, and it won't be satisfied until the removal occurs.
I mean, if I could just say anecdotally speaking, we've worked with hundreds of families have had to report monthly for the INS meetings. We have a couple coming up in the next couple of weeks. And in almost every case, when people think that they're going to be deported, they either do report for the bag and baggage order or they leave the country voluntarily on their own. In almost the majority of cases that we've worked on, the majority of cases that we've known of in the New York area. Furthermore, the overwhaling majority of families that we've worked with that have had to check in for the monthly immigration appointments have done so. Or if they haven't done so, they haven't done so because they're not clear whether they're going to be detained or not. Now, I mean, if you're telling people, well, we're not sure if we're going to detain you or not, but come and check in once a month, and every monthly decision is, am I going to be in jail? Am I going to be in jail? Am I going to be in jail? I mean, you're kind of not creating a lot of incentives for people to comply.
I agree. There's probably not a lot of incentives, and that's why there's 80% of the individuals who we call in don't show up. So, you know, you said your information was anecdotal, and if it's true, hey, that's outstanding. But our statistics show that 80% of the individuals that we call in don't come in.
David Venturella, how many people are now being detained in detention facilities around the United States?
On average, we have about 20 to 21,000 individuals detained.
And how many mass deportations have there been?
Well, I wouldn't characterize them as mass deportations. Last year, we removed 115,000 individuals.
I mean,
every day of the week, people are removed.
Right. I'm talking about the difference between when someone is just put on a flight and when you charter a flight. Like the last one is about two dozen. There are ones of more than 100 flights to Pakistan.
We have either chartered flights or what we use the Justice Prisoner Alien Transportation System. We have flights daily. To Central America, to South America, to the Caribbean, where we have plane loads of up to 60 to 90 individuals. They occur daily. There's weekly schedules. So the charter that happened to the Middle East last week was part of the normal removal system that we have. It's true that the number to the Middle East is only two for this year. But we envision that we'll have more removals to that region in a coordinated effort that we did the last two.
And why does the Justice Department continue to insist on not revealing the names of the people it holds in detention? And these deportations, the mass ones, the ones where you charter a flight, are secret.
You have to talk to the Justice Department about the release of names. But as far as a removal, no, we don't publicize that for the safety of our officers, for the safety of the aircraft personnel, and for the individuals that are being removed. However, the individual knows it. Their attorneys do get notice of it. The receiving countries, a lot of other individuals who have a need to know about the removal are told about it.
But we have ten seconds to.
We don't release it to concerned citizens who have gripes about it.
10 seconds to Ann Benson of Washington Defenders Association Immigration Project.
Again, I think the final point I'd like to emphasize is, even backing up before this, is to the due process of law that people actually aren't getting before they actually get these orders of removal. Not only are there mass deportations in the charter flights, there are mass deportations that we haven't actually gotten to talk about that happen in detention, where groups of people are ordered deported all at once by an immigration judge. And so I think that the due process of law is really in jeopardy for immigrants who are in deportation and removal proceedings.
On that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Ann Benson, Washington Defenders Association Immigration Project. David Venturella, Deputy Director for Detention and Removal Operations at the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And Sabash Katil with Families for Freedom in New York City. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Israel. We'll speak with a reporter who has just left the Jerusalem Post. Stay with us.
I rest my case, I don't cast aside. You better believe it, well that's the truth of it. So take it or leave it, resign to it. Homicide, 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 homicide. Oh, no one can.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli forces yesterday killed a 65-year-old Palestinian, wounded 20 others in a failed attempt to assassinate three members of Hamas in Gaza. Four children were among the injured, including an 8-year-old who remains in critical condition. The BBC reports it's the third strike on Hamas in the last 5 days. Israel's threatened to, quote, liquidate all members of Hamas following last week's bus bombing that killed 21 people in Jerusalem. Tuesday's combined strikes by air and sea were aimed at Hamas commander Khaled Masood, who Israel alleges to have organized mortar strikes against Israeli towns. Today, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat called on militant groups to reinstate the ceasefire they formally ended last week after the assassination of a Hamas leader. This comes at a time of increasing tension between Arafat and the Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, who held emergency cabinet talks in Gaza. The Associated Press reports Arafat asked the legislature to convene Monday for a vote of confidence in Abbas. There's some speculation Abbas may lose that vote. In other news yesterday, Israeli undercover troops stormed a Nablus hospital before dawn, snatched two wounded Palestinian militant members of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade from their beds in the intensive care unit. We go now to David Newman, a professor of political geography at Ben-Gurion University, a former columnist with the Jerusalem Post, where he says he was pressured to leave after 6 years for his political views. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you comment on the latest information and also on why you have left the Jerusalem Post?
Well, obviously, there are two completely separate things here. As far as the latest news coming out of here, it's the ongoing cycle of violence. One side terrorizes, the other side retaliates, and neither side is big enough to be able to say we're the ones who aren't going to retaliate. Peace spoilers, it only takes one or two crazy suicide bombers, creating peace takes a lot more than that. And we've got the government here, which is a right-wing government, but I think any government in Israel at the moment, after the sort of suicide bombs that took place on a bus full of children and civilians in Jerusalem last week, is being pressured very strongly on the ground by the Israeli public, and not just by the right-wing public, for retaliation. And so we get back into this cycle of violence, even though we were living under an illusion for the last 2 or 3 months that maybe, just maybe, we were getting away from the violence.
What about this latest news of the Israeli military pulling patients out of a Nablus hospital in intensive care?
Well, I don't know the veracity of those facts or not, but Israeli intelligence clearly has very specific targets in terms of who they believe are responsible for the suicide bombings, for the terrorism which is going on. The Israeli government's argument is, of course, that they wanted the Palestinian Authority and the Abu Mazen government to deal with this, and they argue that the continuation of the suicide bombings is, as far as they are concerned, evidence of the fact that the Palestinian Authority is not dealing with it, and if they don't deal with it, then the government says, we are going to deal with it.
David Newman, you have been writing about the rightward shift of the Israeli press and how it affects the peace negotiations. Also did a piece, Israel, the Myth of Left-Wing Media Control. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think there's no question whatsoever that the Israeli media and the public opinion, it both reflects public opinion and it sort of takes public opinion forward, has undergone a major shift to the right in the past 4 or 5 years. At the same time, the right-wing talk about the left-wing control of the media in Israel, which today is quite a myth. You look at all the papers that used to be in the center of the political spectrum in Israel. In Hebrew, Yediot Ahronot or Ma'ariv, the English newspaper Jerusalem Post, which used to be the centrist piece reflecting Israel to the world, has probably become the most radical right-wing mouthpiece, even to the right of the Sharon government, criticizing Sharon often for even going forward with the roadmap. It reflects public opinion. It takes public opinion forward. It's a reaction to the violence. In some ways, it's probably similar to the reaction in America to September the 11th. But there's no question that the media has been taken over by the right wing in this country, and it's doing its best to be sort of anti-Palestinian, anti-peace process. And I think the Jerusalem Post has become the leader in this.
And what is the response of columnists and reporters?
I think, you know, you can even read pieces in the liberal left of center Haaretz where reporters are asking themselves, you know, maybe that the government should be taking a harder stance and so on. I think it does reflect a gut reaction on the street to the scenes of suicide bombings on civilian buses. You know, it's quite a natural reaction in some senses. But, of course, these things tend to have short-term waves. You know, after the initial sort of horror, what happens, give it a few days or a week or so, and then you come back to some sort of centrist analysis. That's true of some media outlets. It's not true of other media outlets, which have clearly taken on a very clear political positioning to the right of the political map.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. David Newman was a columnist with the Jerusalem Post. He is no longer. You are listening to Democracy Now! That does it for the show. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359, Democracy Now!'s website. And you can go there and sign up for our daily digest is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Quddus, Lenina Dahl, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Parvez Sharma, Nell Geiser, also Alka Patel. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.